And welcome back to Sanitas. This is Mel Fambergas, and I'm here with my special guest, Gwen Olson, author of the book, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher.
And did I hear you say somewhere that you were trained to misinform at one point?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not at one point. That is the mission, is to misinform and disinform. What it's called is handling physician objections. And reps are very well trained on how to do that. And one of the ways that reps are trained to do that is called toe-to-toes and knee-to-knee trainings. What that is where you have one line of reps that plays the doctor and one line of reps directly opposing them that plays the representative. And what they do is they practice detailing a drug, and the doctor then brings up certain objections that the rep has to handle and minimize. So what you're doing is, if that doctor says, for example, you know, well, I don't like to write a drug that you have to dose three times a day, well, you have to come back with, you know, minimizing that concern. Well, you know, it's three times a day. It has to be taken with meals. This would be ideal for the nursing home patient who has already given their medications or whatever, so you don't have to worry about, you know, those patients having to remember to take their drugs three times a day. So you come back with a way that you minimize that doctor's concern. Well, every single drug you are trained on has a list of doctor's objections. And even if a new drug comes out and you don't have any experience with that, they will immediately start sending information in from the field to the marketing department as what the doctors are objecting to. And then the marketing department will come back with a pat answer that everybody has to repeat verbatim. So that's how you practice those, with your knees, you know, knee to knees if you're sitting, toe to toes if you're standing. And then you move down the line and you practice with the next guy. And then you move down the line and you practice with the next guy. And you keep doing that until everybody sounds like a bunch of mockingbirds saying the exact same thing.
It's just incredible. And as we were approaching our break, we were talking about pediatricians and vets who come back and are not really taken care of. They're basically put on the side. And I have to think, since we're this show is airing in September of 2011, 10th year anniversary of 9/11, how about the first responders who are now dying or have died and are dying with lung problems and cancers, and they're being told, this has nothing to do with 9/11, so go back to sleep. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that it's just like everything else. I think that the government is hiding a lot of information. And of course, now that I've gotten into this, I'm very well aware. I mean, I've been on the Alex Jones show. I've been on some other shows that I've gotten an education that I wish I didn't get, because there actually is, you know, a little bit of ignorance is bliss kind of, you know, thing.
Yes.
Going on. And I couldn't sleep at nights after I started realizing that, you know, our government really is behind a lot of things that is not in our best interest. And people, I believe, are really unaware of that. We think that, you know, well, nobody would intentionally harm us and nobody would intentionally allow these things to happen to us. But we live in the corporate states of America.
Very good.
And
I like that.
We do. We live in the corporate states of America. And if we want to get back to the United States of America, then we're going to have to change not only our government, but we have to change ourselves. And one of the ways that we have to change ourselves is we have to, you say, I'm brave. I'm not brave. I'm compassionate. I'm compassionate, and I'm pissed off, and I'm doing something about it. That's not bravery. It's me moving forward and taking what I know and just doing whatever I can. And that's what everybody needs to do. Let this information be known as widely as possible. Share it with as many people as you can, and stop handing our power over to anyone, including our government, because we're leading ourselves down a very treacherous road that history would shine a light on if we would take a look at it.
But Gwen, we are supposed to believe our well-intended government. Those people who went there on 9/11 that morning to help out, the FDA should be able to say this drug is safe. The EPA was supposed to say that day it is not safe for anybody to even get closer to that area. And Whitman, Secretary Whitman, said it was perfectly safe. And now these people are paying with their lives.
Yes, they are. But again, you know, it's disinformation, it's misinformation. And that's the reason they get away with it, because they own the media. As you know, the mainstream media doesn't report the accurate truth about things. And they actually, they're in the same position that doctors are in that try to come out and speak, you know, speak up. They lose their positions and then they have no voice.
Yes. Yes. And going back to your situation, at one point you stopped talking about what happened to you because nobody really seemed to comprehend. You had experienced a serious adverse drug reaction that left you permanently brain damaged. How were you able to fully recover? And how many other thousands of people have gone and continue to go through this?
Well, you know, there are large numbers of people. And as I was saying, that was really the thing that surprised me the most, is how many people were suffering on these drugs. And I guess the question, I'm sorry, the question.
No, how were you able to fully recover? And how many thousands of people go through the same thing every day and have absolutely no help?
Well, I was able to recover over a period of time. And the statement that I made in my book that I had permanent brain damage, I actually now, and I first wrote the book, it first came out in 2005, I actually do believe that I have gotten a large portion of my function back that I believed I never would. And a big portion of that has come through an intensive detoxification program that I've gone through. I went on a raw foods retreat where I did for a couple of weeks just strictly raw foods. I've gone on a couple of vegetarian retreats where you go and you go through the dry heat sauna, you exercise, you take nutritional supplements to detoxify, you eat only nutritional foods to detoxify. And what that helped do is it helped pull the drugs back through the blood-brain barrier in order for me to get rid of them. What psychiatric drugs are designed to do is to pass through the blood-brain barrier, which, of course, is the layer of fat that is supposed to protect the brain from toxicity. So when the drugs are designed to enter through that, the deal is they're not designed to come back out. So even when you stop taking the drugs, if you have a period, it's kind of like a stroke victim or something, if you have a period of extreme stress or you don't sleep well or something of that nature, then the symptoms, the drugs recirculate and the symptoms resurface. So you have to deal with withdrawal and the problems all over again. So I was actually in a protracted withdrawal state for many, many years and battled with anxiety to a degree that I literally fought my body on a daily basis. So until I found the detoxification process, the nutritional changes that I needed to make, and found out some of the things. I also, you know, had mercury toxicity that I wasn't aware of from my mercury amalgams that I had in my mouth. And so there's lots of things that I have managed to do to detoxify my body and to nutritionally fortify my body and to recover. And I literally do feel like now there is some repair that has gone on within the last 2 or 3 years with the brain damage that I had experienced.
Well, that's great.
So there are ways to heal. The problem is finding people who really know what's going on and how to manage these drugs, because nobody is trained on how to do that. It's a hit and miss prospect, and a lot of people who are trying to do it in the alternative healthcare community are doing it at great risk.
Yes, yes. A few years ago, I spoke to a lady who lived in Colorado, I believe. She had a daughter with muscular dystrophy and another one with autism. She told me that she found some herbs and she was able to address both conditions, and she was basically told to get out of the country or else. Now she's in Alaska somewhere and I lost contact, but she's been speaking really loud that there are ways to cure. Planet Earth, nature has given us every single cure out there. And why is it that the government really gets into, if it's something that could cure something, make it an illegal drug? But you worked, and speaking of children and the blood-brain barrier, I want to touch on this very important subject. You worked in the foster care system as a court-appointed special advocate. Did you find that a lot of the children were being placed on psychotropic drugs?
Oh, absolutely. And that is actually, that is the subject matter of the next book that I've contributed to that's going to be coming out in September, and it's called Drugging Our Children, How Profiteers Are Pushing Antipsychotics on Our Children and What We Can Do About It. And that is one of the areas that I realized right off the bat that children who were in foster care or under the custody of the state or in the custody of the state were almost immediately drugged. And these were children that we're talking about that were 2, 3, and 4 years old. I mean, these weren't older children that were having problems. These were very young children.
2-year-olds.
That would come into the system and almost immediately, well, the child's bedwetting, you know, so the child's got to be put on antidepressants. Excuse me, it's a 2-year-old that's just got ripped out of the arms of its mother and given to a foster home, you know? I mean, bedwetting might be a problem that the child needs to have addressed, but maybe it just needs to be rocked and held and assured, not drugged.
Well, wait a second.
You know what I'm saying?
Of course, but you were a pharmaceutical sales rep. What do you think of them giving a 2-year-old a major antipsychotic drug?
I had major problems with it. That was another thing that, you know, I fought the court system because I knew how dangerous these drugs were. I knew they weren't indicated for children under 18 years of age. I knew that there were serious ramifications for developing bodies and minds and livers and kidneys and brains and things of that nature. These drugs were not designed for children. But yet, they're commonly given to elderly people, they're given to children, they're given to anyone that will take them because they're the most lucrative drugs that are available. And if you don't believe me, look at what the top-selling drug category has been for the last 3 years, antipsychotics.
Was bedwetting one of the reasons of putting a child under a psychotic drug?
It could be bedwetting. It could be temper tantrums. It could be not paying attention in school. It could be anything. They found any reason, and there was no exception to the rule. I fought for every child that I had to keep them from being drugged and was only successful in keeping the 2 smallest children that I had from being drugged.
If these powerful drugs should be used for psychosis and schizophrenia, how logical is it to go and expose a 2-year-old to them?
It isn't logical, and we're the only country in the world that is doing it to the extent that we are. I talk to psychiatrists in Europe and in other countries, Australia and other places, and they're appalled that we drug our children to the degree that we do and with the major drugs that we use.
But obviously,
so it's just,
obviously a doctor or a psychiatrist prescribe this for the children. Don't they know that their major organs like kidneys, liver, you name it, cannot fully, and the blood-brain barrier, and they cannot metabolize or eliminate the drugs properly?
They should know that, and they should be aware of that. But what you have to understand is we are a big part of the problem ourselves, the parents and the guardians of these children, because and I'm not saying that parents are bad parents, okay? Because I understand that we all have full plates, and most families have 2 working parents, and, you know, there's a lot on their agendas. However, I believe that sometimes drugs are the quick fix answer even to a problem that they have with a child that may be a disciplinary issue. And children get drugged rather than spanked in our society.
Yes.
When I was growing up, if I acted out, I would have gotten my rear end busted, and then I wouldn't have done it again.
That's right.
And boy, my parents looked at me cross-eyed, and I was not an abused child per se in terms of I was not beaten.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't that kind of thing, but if my parents looked at me cross-eyed and we were out in public, they didn't even have to say anything.
I knew
better. If you discipline a child in public, even discipline them by yelling at them, and I'm not being, you know, like abusive yelling, I'm saying, stop doing that.
Right.
You know,
yep.
Someone will threaten to call CPS on you in this day and
that's
age.
Right.
I can guarantee you they will, because that's the way our society is programmed. Because once women's lib, and I read a book about how the Russians and how the KGB and everything talked about how they had planned to do this to destroy American society by taking women out of the homes, because when they took women out of the homes and supported women's liberation and all that, it caused the disintegration of the family. And children became the property of the state because they spent more time in daycare and more time in schools, and therefore the state could have a greater influence on our families. And that's exactly where we are today.
You know, what you're saying makes so much sense, and I wish it weren't true. This is not a science fiction show that we're doing, folks. This is reality. And speaking of the children, once again, don't they become neurotoxic, these drugs, since they cross the blood-brain barrier, since they're not fully developed.
That's how pediatric bipolar illness was born. That's how Dr. Joseph Biederman from Harvard promised the makers of one of the major antipsychotic manufacturers that his studies could prove that these drugs were effective in pediatric bipolar disorder. And that was before he even did the clinical trials. Now, this man was one that was investigated by Senator Grassley and his committee, and they found that he, quote unquote, inadvertently forgot to report $1.6 million that he'd gotten from this particular drug manufacturer to Harvard. Okay? Pediatric bipolar illness did not exist prior to the 1960s and 70s when we started drugging our children with Ritalin and other stimulant drugs for ADHD. There was nothing that said that children under the age of 18 ever had exemplified these symptoms. What happened was, once they started stimulating children with stimulants for ADHD, they started developing these psychoses and maniac types of behaviors, and they started surfacing in the literature, and all of a sudden, voila, pediatric bipolar disorder was born. And that was where Dr. Biederman popularized it by going out then. He was the most published psychiatrist in history, just about, and had like 7,000 some articles that were written about, or where he was referenced and his studies were referenced about pediatric bipolar disorder. And he literally, this one man, popularized this disease, and now our children are suffering the consequence of it.
This may not be...
And he was paid to do so. Millions of dollars.
Incredible. I had a conversation with Dr. Rauni Kilde, former chief medical doctor in Finland. And we were talking about cell phones. And she was telling me that kids today, I mean, you see them in school with their cell phones, and the radiation, because their blood-brain barrier is not developed, it goes into their brain and eventually is going to cause brain cancer, and nobody's going to be able to point the finger at what happened. But anyway, we have Ericsson, the cell phone manufacturing company in Finland. Her nephew came one day about 10 years old and said, "I want a cell phone." And she said, "No, you shouldn't have a cell phone." And she said, the little kid said, he was, in that school, and he said, "There's only one kid in my school that doesn't use a cell phone, and is the son of the chairman of the board for Ericsson." So let me ask you, pharmaceutical companies, do you think the people high up there would give their own families and loved ones these medication?
Well, let me just give you a little example to answer that question. Do you know when they go around and they're doing their mobile units where you roll up your sleeve and get your shot?
Yes.
In the drive-through in the parking lot? They were doing that here in Texas during the H1N1 scare.
Right.
And where you, this morning I walked into the grocery store and they were offering me a 10% discount on my groceries if I got a shingles vaccine.
Oh, yes.
And there was a table at the front of my grocery store offering me a shingles vaccine. Well, guess what? When I was a pharmaceutical rep, we weren't allowed to get the flu vaccine. Do you know why?
Why?
Because my district manager said, well, first of all, we don't make those vaccines. And secondly, HR did a survey, and when we vaccinated our reps, we had more time out of the field than when we didn't. You get enough immunity by touching doorknobs and water fountains and people sneezing on you and everybody that you talk to. You don't need a flu vaccine. And guess what? They didn't used to vaccinate our children for that very same reason either until 2003. Look into the statistics. The mortality and morbidity rate for children since they've started getting vaccinated hasn't improved. It has declined.
This is just incredible. How are you allowed to continue talking without any repercussions, Gwen?
You can't say that there haven't been repercussions because I have to try to make a living now. And sometimes I'll get a speaking engagement, like with a pharmacy school. I've done a couple of those, and then all of a sudden that speaking engagement disappears.
Drops.
I'll get a radio interview where I'm supposed to be on Diane Sawyer, or TV interview where I'm supposed to be with Diane Sawyer. I'm supposed to be doing something else, and that interview will disappear, or that opportunity will disappear. Things disappear all the time in terms of opportunities for me. But you say, how am I allowed to keep doing it? I flew under the radar for a very long time. I'm not stupid. I'm smart. And I've used all of the training that I was given by the pharmaceutical industry against them. And I flew under the radar long enough to where that I got a very large following in the natural health industry, so that if something were to happen to me and I just disappeared, or, you know, something, they try to sue me or something, I have a following.
Absolutely.
I have people who know about me. I have people that will say, hey, what happened to Gwen Olson? Mm-hmm. In fact, if I'm not on Facebook for a couple of days, people panic.
So, yeah.
You know, so I, how I've continued to do this is that this is my spiritual calling, Mel.
That's right.
This is what I do in order to sleep good at night, based on what I have participated in and what I did in my 15-year tenure in the industry. This is how I'm giving back, and this is how I'm trying to make a difference.
The more public you become, the better it is for you and your loved ones. But what is the logic, speaking, going back to the children? I know some children have emotional issues, especially if they are going to foster homes and so on. They must have emotional issues. But isn't there another way to deal with this? How about talk therapy?
Exactly. Talk therapy, play therapy. There, I mean, again, a big part of what children's problems are, I mean, we're talking about foster children that have been abused or neglected, so, you know, that's generally not having to do with nutrition. But when we're drugging our children also because of, you know, ADHD symptoms or hyperactivity, they can't sit still, they can't concentrate, they're not doing well in school, a big part of that has to do with the trash that we feed our kids that has absolutely no nutrition in it, you know. And I try to tell parents and try to educate parents about, I'm not judging. I was one of those parents that drove through McDonald's and got my kids something for breakfast before school too at one point in time.
Yeah.
But I started learning that, you know, if we are what we eat and all we eat is trash, guess what we become?
Trash.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately. And the pharmaceutical industry is counting on us having those diets, because the sicker we become, the more pills they can sell us.
Absolutely. And you, Gwen, it is obvious to me that the motivation by the pharmaceutical industry is simply, if we had to summarize everything, please, anybody who's listening out there, don't tell me that they're doing this just to be altruistic and to save the world. It's simply profit. I have to ask, if it is obvious, as it is to me, that you don't prescribe potent antipsychotic drugs to a two-year-old who doesn't have his organs fully developed, aren't doctors supposed to take an oath? Aren't doctors aware of this? And if so, why are they prescribing the drugs? Yes, we can blame the pharmaceutical industries, but what about the doctors?
Well, I believe that the doctors do have a culpability, and I would love to be able to have a forum with doctors, but very rarely do I ever get to speak to medical professionals, because medical professionals are, they have an investment in following the guidelines that they're given by the FDA and by the industry. And if they don't follow those guidelines, then, as I said, their careers are at risk. They can be sued. They can have their licenses taken away from them. So they do have a responsibility, but what I see a lot of doctors doing in protest is literally giving up their practices and going into some kind of integrative cash pay type of business, because they don't want to deal with insurance. They don't want to deal with all of the, you know, the legalities that they're having to deal with in the current practice that they're in.
Right, right. And as a pharmaceutical,
you know?
Of course, and as a pharma rep, I understand that you had goals, quotas, bonuses to be made. More than likely, you had a district manager that you reported to. Most drugs come with that warnings. Did you ever have a district manager who was honest and told you to make sure that when you're representing these drugs to your customers, did your boss want you to push the sale, or did you have anyone honest enough who wanted you to discuss the warnings and risks so that physicians could pass that information to their patients?
Well, I have to admit, I'm very grateful that when I started in the industry in 1985, I was trained by a very old school district manager who had been in the industry for many years. And he was someone I had great admiration and respect for, and still do to this day, because he did train me that I was supposed to give fair, balanced disclosure, that I should give the doctor all of the information, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and let him make an informed decision. That's what informed consent is based
right.
on. If you don't have all of the information, you can't make an informed decision. So he would constantly encourage me, and he would say, if you don't know the answer, don't BS. Do not fake an answer ever in terms of what you do or do not know, because lives could depend on you giving someone false information. So you always learn to say, I don't know, but I'll get back to you. And you get an answer to that question. So because that was the way I was trained and that was my initial experience, when I got other district managers later in my career and, you know, when I continued to get manager after manager who was only about the bottom line, I in fact had one manager at one point that turned to me and told me there was no place for integrity in sales, and I'm quoting him. And because I told him I thought that was out of integrity that he was asking me to do something, and he said, well, then you need to reconsider because there's no place for integrity in sales. So, I mean, I just do believe that it was that one district manager that gave me the conscience that I had about the industry and had me observe, put me in that observer mode that made me more conscientious and aware than I believe some of my counterparts may have been about what was going on.
And I bet you that former district manager wouldn't be too popular with upper management these days and the stockholders.
No, he retired a long time ago. Those individuals, if you push back too much, you end up getting ousted.
Yes.
They retire people that have too much. You know, if you won't play ball and do things that they want them to do, or you question or you push back, they get rid of you.
Yes. Don't rock the boat. Just play the game.
You have to be really, really good.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Once you're branded with a serious psychiatric diagnosis, is it even possible to receive treatment that does not involve chemical restraint?
Very rarely. I mean, insurance very rarely covers any kind of talk therapy. And even if you do have talk therapy, it's generally you're going to be medicated and get talk therapy along with that. But no, pretty much once a person is given a psychiatric diagnosis, and particularly if it's a major psychiatric diagnosis such as schizophrenia or bipolar illness, you are going to be drugged without exception. And if you refuse to be drugged, in many circumstances, you can be forcibly drugged.
So what do we have now? Just a 50-minute session with the therapist, the psychiatrist, and then the rest is, you know, take this drug and come back see me in a month? Is that the way that things are done now?
Yeah. Basically, your psychologists are the people who do the majority of talk therapy.
Right.
Now, psychiatrists very rarely do talk therapy, and if they do, they're very old school generally, very older physicians, because the younger psychiatrist or the newer psychiatrist has 15-minute appointments where they do medication
yes.
management. So all they do basically is come in, well, how are you feeling on your drugs? Are you sleeping okay? Do you have any complaints? And I mean, basically that's all it is. It's medication management. And very frequently they have to use one drug after the other after the other. It's never a one-time, you know, take this drug and your problems are going to be resolved. With psychiatric drugs, it's try this, try that. Well, this didn't work. No, that's a problem. Try this. Now we'll add that. Now we'll add this. And you end up getting all of these comorbid psychiatric diagnoses. You may start out, like I said, being depressed. Then you end up bipolar. Then over time, you're schizoaffective. Then you're schizophrenic. I mean, it goes from one diagnosis to the next, and they add another drug and another drug and another drug. And pretty soon, you are one of the, by the way, I need to give you the statistic, one of the 1,100 people that goes on disability on a daily basis in this country for mental illness. And of that number, 250 of them are children.
That's just incredible.
Disability. That means they can't work, they can't go to school, they can't function, they're disabled because they're on psychiatric drugs.
So what is the system supposed to do with a disabled child like that, if there's so much preponderance?
Well, what do we do with them? They just end up being, they sit in the system
yes.
forever.
Yes. And
they sit in the system forever, and they're non-productive citizens. And pretty soon, they're people that, you know, they're the outcasts of society.
You know, when I look back at Columbine, Virginia Tech, and even the Tucson Massacre, I look at these people. They must have had some kind of, if they're not mind-controlled, some kind of drug reaction. Have you seen any studies of those people who committed these crimes to see if they have had any experience with, you know, psychotic drugs, antipsychotic drugs?
Without exception. without exception. In fact, if you look into all of the school shootings, look into any of the women that kill all of their children,
yes,
or the men who kill the entire family and the dog and then themselves. Mm. You look into these cases, and initially, you know, we hear about, oh, well, they lost their job, or they were depressed, or they were divorcing and they were depressed, or they were this and they were depressed. Look into these stories, and you'll realize soon that there is a common theme that runs through all of them. They were either depressed and being treated for depression, or they had gone off of their depression treatment.
Which one is worse?
It's always one or the other. And if they've gone off, of course, that leads the pharmaceutical industry and the doctors and psychiatrists and everybody to say, oh, well, they should have been on
that's
their
right.
drugs. You know, that's their proof that they should have been on their drugs. When what it is actually is that there are three periods of time where there's a lot of instability and risk involved with taking psych drugs. When you first initiate the therapy, if you increase the dose or decrease the dose, and when you stop the therapy. There's a lot of risk there if you think about it.
But it's a catch-22, because if you continue with the drug, yeah, things are going to happen. And if you abandon the drug, things are going to happen. So which one is best?
Thank you. And that's where my dilemma lies when many people come to me and they say, you know, I've been on antidepressants for 20 years. I've been on these for 15. I've been on, you know, there are some people that I don't take their hope away from them, but I know in my heart of hearts that they may not be one of the people that can be helped. They may not ever be able to get off the drugs and live a productive and, you know, pain-free life. It's that serious of a situation. So if you're considering, if you're listening to this radio show now and you are considering taking a psychiatric drug, an anxiolytic, an anxiety reducing agent like a benzodiazepine, like Xanax or Valium or Klonopin, if you've been prescribed an antidepressant, I don't care what category of antidepressant, if you've been given an antipsychotic and told that it's for something like depression, like Seroquel or Abilify or something of that nature, you need to do your due diligence, because once you go down that path, you are opening up a can of worms that you will not be able to undo. Possibly for years, you will be suffering the outcome of that.
And once again, let's not forget about the psychiatrist. Aren't they known by the industry as drug whores, because they have no loyalty to a specific company, but to the one that pays them the most? Please explain.
I love interviewers who've actually read my book, Mel.
I have to.
Yes, and that's one of the things I think that has irritated a vast number of psychiatrists that I had talked to today, is that I'm really trying to bring to their awareness that the industry does not have any respect for psychiatry. The pharmaceutical industry makes fun of psychiatrists. Every company that I ever worked for that sold a psychiatric drug considered that particular profession their drug whores. And the reason they considered them their drug whores was because psychiatrists are known to endorse any and every drug maker or manufacturer that will pay them to do so.
Well,
they have no loyalty
well, that's because
to any
they,
individual.
They didn't do anything scientifically. It was all subjective diagnosis.
Right. There is nothing scientific for them to do. And that's the reason why the industry doesn't, I mean, medicine as a whole looks down on psychiatry. And if they don't know that, then they are delusional, which I find very interesting. Because I found that, you know, psychiatrists were willing, because they want to be doctors that are credible physicians.
Yeah.
That's what the take that I have on it anyway. You know, but they really don't have credible diagnostic tools. So when they diagnose a patient, it's a third party subjective observation of what they consider to be maladaptive behavior.
Right.
It's that individual's call. I have seen pilot programs where we're trying to show that, you know, you could get a multitude of diagnoses from one individual going in and telling, you know, multiple psychiatrists the exact same symptoms and get three or four different diagnoses and several different drug regimens prescribed to them. They're not even uniform because there's no way of determining this stuff. It's a checklist that's called the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual that they use, the DSM, which they use to check off symptoms and look at these symptoms, and then they say you have this or that illness, and you get that label. And that DSM has tripled in terms of the number of psychiatric diagnoses that you can have in just the past decade or so. It's tripled in size. And they're going to expand it again. And they add things into it like a psychiatric illness that's fear of mother-in-laws or fear of peanut butter sticking to the roof of your mouth. I'm not kidding you.
Really?
You think I'm making this up?
Are you not?
That's a diagnosis.
Oh, this is just incredible.
And you can get drugged for that, Mel.
You can get a drug because you like this guy the way it looks today, I guess.
You can get drugged for anything. If you say something that makes you look like you are outside of what's considered to be the norm and another person determines that, you can be drugged.
And that's the thing. What is normality these days? I remember growing up, my parents would say, hey, after you come back from school, get out there, play ball on the street, and just come back when the sun goes down. That was norm back then. That's not normality these days. And the same thing is happening with drugs now. And yes, don't get me wrong. I remember kids in my school who had ADHD, and all of a sudden they're prescribed Ritalin, and they change, completely change forever. But I think a DSM is, and I hate to carpet bomb all of them, because I bet there are good psychiatrists and psychologists out there. But psychologists, of course, they don't prescribe. But they are basically prescription mills, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. They are. They definitely are. And they have no other tools in their armamentarium. So what you need to understand is that if it's proven, if they come out and debunk the theory that, you know, all of these problems are caused by brain chemistry imbalances and that these drugs don't work, which they don't work, and I encourage everyone, please read my book, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher, but if you can't read that book and you want to read something about the efficacy of the drugs, read Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whitaker, and he will very nicely lay out for you how none of the drugs work. The clinical data proves that these drugs don't work. And so it's a hit and miss anyway. And, you know, this will inform you as to why this is happening and what you really need to do and look out for your kids. Because that's where my passion lies. I think as adults, we have the ability and we should be able to make our own decisions about what we put into our bodies. I don't care if it's food, alcohol, cigarettes, drugs, whatever. I think we should be able, as long as we're not harming anyone else, we should be able to make that decision.
Good.
But when we're talking about our children,
yes,
we're talking about innocent bystanders that don't have the rights that we have. Our animals have more rights than our children do in this country. And we have a moral responsibility to get it right for our kids. And that means we have to do our own due diligence. And these drugs are not the answer. 99.9% of the time, they're not the answer. I'm not saying that there might not be a crisis situation where one of these drugs might not be beneficial for a short-term intervention. But long term, not one of these drugs has a positive outcome or a positive story that I can tell you about. Even with the individuals that believe that their children have gotten better, and you know, what is better? Are they quieter? Are the lights on but nobody's home?
Right.
Because I don't think that that's improvement. Because I know parents that tell me that they, you know, well, these kids have to be drugged because if they're not drugged, they're disrupting the class and the rest of the children, they don't get, you know, their studies and everything. And I say, okay, well, then we could rope them to their chair and we could put a gag on them. Would that be acceptable to you? Well, that's ridiculous. I would never do that, and I'd never stand for that. That's child abuse. Well, that's what they're doing to these children chemically. They're putting them in chemical straitjackets, and they're impairing their brain function in order to keep them quiet. Well, that's not acceptable to me either, people.
I remember during the swine flu time, I did a show on anti-vaccines, especially the H1N1, and I received an email from a lady, I think she was in Arkansas, and she said, how dare you speak against vaccines? There have been, I believe it was 5,000 volunteers in Arkansas to go and vaccinate their children, and she was one of them. I wonder what happened there. But then again, I received email from people in New York, from the public health in New York, writing saying, thanks for what you're doing, because it made me rise up. And as you remember, during the swine flu time, all the health practitioners in New York rose and said, we're not taking it. So if the health people, the nurses and so on, were not taking the vaccine, what does that tell the general population?
Well, it should tell them something, and that's what I'm saying. Look around you. Ask. I mean, I'd like to know if these physicians, like you said, would give these drugs to their own children, because I guarantee you that they would not.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, speaking of psychiatrists once again, why are they so ego-driven that they literally recommend anything when given the appropriate sales pitch?
Well, that's not my... Psychology isn't my area of expertise, and I really don't know, but I do have an idea. And my idea is, like I said, that they want medical legitimacy. They've been made fun of. They were a fringe specialty for a long time that were only allowed to practice in institutions. And, oh, my God, if you look into the history of psychiatry, they used to use ice picks and, you know, stab people in the brains behind their ears and destroy their brain tissue to try to get them under control. They used to use ice water, put ice water in their brains. They're all kinds of horrendous, horrible treatments in past, you know, in our history in psychiatry. But it's not any different today. It just looks nicer. It's just like war isn't any different today than it was, you know, 100 years ago. People still get maimed and they die and there are consequences. We just don't see it. It looks a little tidier from our perspective.
And speaking of other children, we hear of how much illegal drugs have been introduced in schools. I remember during my time, and I bet your time too, perhaps people in high school would be exposed to marijuana. But now even third graders are being exposed to the most powerful illegal drugs. But do parents know that children are the largest demographic on the pharmaceutical radar?
Probably not, but they're learning very quickly. And what they are learning, unfortunately, is when they're burying their kids and they didn't even know they were experimenting and using pharmaceuticals for recreation because they believe that pharmaceuticals are safe. My son, when he was in high school, would come to me and tell me, Mom, I have friends that wouldn't smoke pot, they wouldn't drink, they wouldn't smoke a cigarette, but they are popping Valiums, they're popping their friends Ritalin, they're popping every kind of prescription drug that they can get their hands on out of the medicine cabinet because they think it's safe.
Right. Especially
because a doctor prescribed
exactly
it.
Because the doctor said so. And in the case of Meg, your niece, and all the prescribed antidepressant drugs, you say, quote, without adequate support, Meg was sent adrift on an inflatable raft with a hole in it in the vast deadly sea known as the American health care system. It was inevitable she would eventually perish. This is the story, probably, Gwen, for so many people out there whose kids are fortunately still alive, but they're navigating in a raft with a hole in it. Tell them something to stop it.
Well, I think that the biggest thing that we can do with our children is to talk to them and to educate them, because we have a problem in our generation, particularly in my generation. I'm 52 years old, and I think that my generation talks out of both sides of its mouth about drugs because we are the generation of the 70s where, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll
right.
were the motto of the day. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And so we really, a lot of us experimented with psychedelic drugs growing up, and we don't have this horrible perception of drugs that maybe some of the older people or older generations may have had. And what we need to start doing is to start realizing that these are not innocuous drugs that our children are experimenting and taking. They are not drugs that will not have long-term consequences. In fact, if they're going to be concerned and they're asking questions about alcohol and drug abuse, they better make prescription drugs their first area of concern, because there have been many more children that have died on prescription drugs. I have never heard of one child that has lost his life on marijuana.
That's right. That's right.
Not one. I'm not endorsing it and saying that we should promote it for our kids, but I'm saying that I think people have their undies in a bundle about the wrong thing.
I think alcohol is more detrimental to the person taking it and the person around them. I mean, I don't
Absolutely.
Know the last time that somebody on pot crashed into somebody.
But that's another agenda for the pharmaceutical industry.
Sure.
You need to be aware in keeping marijuana from being legalized because of all of the medicinal benefits that have been proven. Now, not this isn't hearsay, that have been proven to exist with marijuana. They are fighting tooth and nail to keep that drug from being in the public's hands legally because they don't want us to be able to treat depression, anxiety, glaucoma, whatever things that we want to treat with our own medicinal
right.
herbs that we can grow in our backyard. They do not want that to happen.
Absolutely. That's why I keep saying the hemp industry used to be massive in the United States, and you could manufacture anything with it, from medicinal products for industrial products. With the economy the way it is, if you brought back the hemp industry, you can be sure that our manufacturing base would rise up again. But again, because it's related to that, they don't want, the lobbyists are trying to keep it away because it will probably hurt somebody's profit margin.
That's right. Exactly. It would hurt somebody's profit margin. And I mean, with the research that I've been doing into cancer and everything for my next book, I can see exactly why they're trying to keep that from being legalized.
And you know, I keep talking about Meg because I think this is an example that should not, she should not die in vain. And she was an honor student. She was a pre-med student and wanted to eventually become a surgeon to help disfigured children. All of a sudden, things changed when she started using the prescription drugs. But aside from all the drugs she was prescribed, Gwen, did she get any kind of therapy or counseling where she could sit down with an unbiased third party? It seems that what she needed was compassion, no more drugs, don't you think?
Yes, and I think I said that. I do believe that that's exactly what she needed was compassion, and she didn't have the support system, and I believe that's where a lot of children meet their demise in the system, is they don't have the support system that they need. And when it comes to younger kiddos, they often can't even verbalize. They don't know what's happening to them. They don't understand why that, you know, they're having these strange symptoms and reactions. And these are kiddos. They can't verbalize it to even put their finger on what the cause of this symptom is. And that's the reason I think that it's not identified. It's largely not identified when children have drug reactions and they're acting, you know, out because of drugs. It looks like a behavioral issue, and they very often are abusing prescription drugs as well. They may not be smoking pot. They may not be drinking, but they may be popping pills at school, and that's what you're getting the residual outcome from. And parents just need to be assertive, and they need to talk to their kids, and they need to make them aware. Share things on the news with them. Share with them and have discussions, meaningful discussions about why four or five kids in their high school class committed suicide. If you look into these things, and of course we always talk about suicide prevention, and the first thing that comes up for suicide prevention is they all need to be on more drugs.
Drugs, exactly.
Do your homework. They were already on drugs. That's why they committed suicide. Don't just listen to what the media, the mainstream media reports about it. Do some more due diligence, because generally down the road, weeks later, when everybody stopped paying attention, the information comes out.
You said when I asked you if you have ever been threatened or, you know, disinvited from a show all of a sudden, all you need to do is turn on the TV, the major mainstream media channels, and all you have to do is look at the commercials. What percentage of all the commercials is medicine or pharmaceutical related? So that tells you that those sponsors are watching. And if they see Gwen Olson coming to 60 Minutes or one of those high-profile programs, you better be sure that somebody's going to place a phone call. Is that what you think is happening mm-hmm. here?
Oh, absolutely. I was on the Dr. Oz show, and they put the segment on the internet, and for 3 days it was hacked into, and nobody could get into it.
Huh.
And I mean, it was like, not available, not available, not available. And so finally it did come back. But I think they do that purposefully because, you know, everybody was like interested then after it, well, I'm not saying everybody, but the people that I was trying to send the information to and get them to see the show and whatnot, you know, were interested in seeing it, but you couldn't access it. So by the time that, you know, people lost interest and wouldn't go back probably 3, 4, 5 days later to look for it, then it finally they got it fixed and it got online. But that's the way that they will intervene in order to get information, you know, quieted. And they're very proactive, believe me. They're a very, very proactive organization. They always put their spin out initially, and they try to get their version of a story out first. they rarely will come back and retract anything.
Yeah. I call it the mediaopoly, by the way, because they're controlled just by a few corporations, including the pharmacy. I would love to know how many pharmaceutical companies, how much they own of the mainstream media. And I bet you that if it's not them directly, it's probably through a third company, subsidiary of those companies, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's just a few families, really, that own the major stock in those fields anyway, you know. They go hand in hand. I mean, if people really follow the money trail, Mel, they can find out a lot of information that they won't want to know. Because when you start realizing that the same people who own the stocks for the pharmaceutical companies are the same people who own the major media channels, are the same people who own the grocery stores that they're pushing the vaccines through now, are the it all goes back to the same people have the money trail, and that's what it is about. It's about profiteering. And I know that that disturbs people because we like to think of us, you know, our country as being a place of freedom and of opportunity. And I believe that we still are to a very small degree compared to what it used to be since the Patriot Act and all of the things that they have instituted. But we can recapture that freedom, and we can take back our country because we have the numbers. That's what people are failing to recognize. That's why that all of these laws are being put into place to try to control us, because our numbers are being harder and harder to control. And as soon as the masses realize that, we will no longer be under control.
How did you come to an awakening towards the pharmaceutical industry? Did this happen all at once, or was it a slow drip process?
It was a slow drip process. I was very young. I was in my mid-20s when I went into the pharmaceutical industry, and I had a very altruistic, you know, vision about what I was going to do and how I was going to help people. And my district manager that was going to hire me asked me, you know, well, why do you want to be in the pharmaceutical industry? And I said, well, I want to help people. And he kind of laughed and smirked, and he looked at me and he says, well, then maybe you ought to join the Peace Corps, you know, because that's really not what we're here to do. But if you want to retire a millionaire, let me show you how much money you can make in this industry. And he turned around and started working on his calculator and, you know, telling me about my benefits and everything. So that's what it's about. It's about money. And as long as we're aware that that's what it's about and we refuse to let people profit off of us with their lies, their deception, their collusion, then we can take our power back.
Absolutely. And as I told you offline, Gwen, I do this show so we can leave a better world for our children. And I'm sure you do too. Do you have a message for the parents?
Yes, I do. And that is, just like they say that it takes a village to raise a child, it also takes a village to protect one. So even though you may not be responsible for the child next door that's on one of these drugs, or you may not be responsible for the elderly person that you know that's in a nursing home that's being placed on one of these drugs for dementia, because you now have this information under your belt, because you have listened to this program and I have shared this with you, there is a certain truth that ring, I mean, there's a certain ring to the truth that just, you know, people will get it. It will get through, and you will know that what I'm saying is the truth. And once you start to do your own due diligence and you start to uncover it, then you'll be on my bandwagon eventually. But until then, you just need to continue to realize that this can be changed, and together we can change it. But it takes every one of us. Don't sit around and wait for me to do it. Don't wait for Mel to do it. Don't wait for the next president to do it. Get off your butt and do something yourself, even if it's inform your neighbor, even if it's inform the person at the grocery store that you happen to overhear a conversation, because you too now share a moral responsibility because we share the truth.
Absolutely. And how do people get your great book, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher?
On my website at gwenolsen.com, G-W-E-N-O-L-S-E-N.com, and you can get it in any of the online booksellers, Amazon.com. But if you buy it off of my website, I'll be happy to autograph it for you. And I really appreciate anyone's support of my work, because this is how I make my living now. And I'm also available for speaking engagements if anyone has a venue that they would like me to share my information in.
And by the way, what are your plans for the near future?
My plans for the near future, I have I made a contribution to a book that's coming out by Prager Publications. Say that real fast,
yeah.
Twice. And it's entitled Drugging Our Children, How Profiteers Are Pushing Antipsychotics on Our Children and How We Can Stop Them. And I've contributed to that with a number of other well-known authors and activists and psychologists. And then after that, I have my own book coming out at the beginning of next year, my second book, which will be entitled Duped, Doped, and Dying in America.
Great. Gwen Olson, a brave, compassionate, and passionate guest. I am so looking forward to your future work, and I hope that we can continue being in touch, because you are one of a kind. Thank you so much for being part of the program.
Thank you for having me, Mel. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Make it a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Gwen Olson. As I always say, if this interview makes a difference in one person's life, we did our job. I hope that if you or a loved one has gone through or is going through what we discussed, that you can ask questions. And just because someone has credentials, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do your own research. Many times, we don't ask questions because we believe that what the doctor says must be right. Medical errors affect 1 in 10 patients worldwide. Almost everyone has heard of the Hippocratic Oath, which in essence is attributed to the phrase, first, do no harm. Sometimes, prescribing a drug that is known to cause harm is breaking that oath. If you're a doctor and you're listening, treat your patients as you would treat your own mother or father, or even your own children. People's lives are depending on you. And I'll leave you with a parent's creed extracted from Gwen Olson's book. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. And if a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Fambregas. Until next week, be well, and remember that your health and longevity should not be classified information.